First of all, Virtus Avi Mori, those were beautiful words, and I'm so pleased and privileged to be able to follow them. And thanks as well, deep, extraordinary thanks to Rabbi Dr. Berman, my teacher and mentor, and my teacher and mentor, Rabbi Penner, in exceedingly accomplished darshan, an extraordinary, an even more extraordinary teacher, and someone whom I'm deeply privileged to learn from. I'll never forget, I believe it was at a family Hanukkah party, and my grandmother, Alaa Shalom, Mindy Lam, turned to my grandfather and said something to the effect of, "You know, you never compliment me anymore." And immediately, without batting an eyelash, he turns to my grandmother and he goes, "You know what? You're right. You have better in-laws than I do." And it was the sort of thing that you, it took you a minute to figure out. And at the same time, it took you a lifetime to marvel at how ingrained a sense of whimsy, humor, fun, playfulness must be in a person in order to summon that depth of wit at a moment's notice. And that, in fact, is what I want to talk about this evening. I'm actually gonna to share my screen, if I may. And it looks indeed like I may. Here we go. What I would like to speak about is, what is the Torah's view on fun and games? And the reason I'd like to do this is because fun, humor, wit, whimsy was such an important and prodigious theme in my grandfather's writings. And yet, it's a theme that I have not seen spoken about or written upon at all in the years since his passing. And it struck me as a major desideratum in scholarship and appreciation of my grandfather. And so I wanted to talk about it this evening. What I want to do is at the very opening here, and I'll translate for you. I'd like to juxtapose two passages from the introduction to my grandfather's book of Torah insights, his Sefer and Chidushei Torah, Halachos VaHalichos. Halachos VaHalichos, published in 1990, is probably his least known work. But he remarked often. And I had the privilege of speaking with Rabbi J.J. Schachter about this morning, who actually published these remarks in an appreciation of my grandfather and tradition. My grandfather often remarked that Halachos VaHalichos was his favorite work, is the one that was most important to him. And his book on the Shema was his favorite English work, but that's for another time. The Halachos VaHalichos is the only major work that he published in Hebrew, though he authored numerous articles in Hebrew. It was the only major book that he published in Hebrew, and it contains his wonderful insights into Torah study. But I'd like to call attention actually to two stories that he tells in the introduction to Halachos VaHalichos, and the reason I do so is because therein he tells the tale of the two Torah giants who most influenced him. The first was, well, the second rather, and most famous was Rabbi Soloveitchik Zatzal, the Rav, the great, possibly the greatest Jewish thinker of the 20th century. But the other, less well known, but perhaps even more formative in my grandfather, was his grandfather, Rabbi Yeshua Baumol, of blessed memory, who was the youngest Rosh Yeshiva in the history of Vizhnitz, was a prominent, distinguished thinker in his own right, was the author of a set of Shilas and Tshuvos called the Emek Halacha. My grandfather, in the opening to Halachos VaHalichos, in describing the intellectual and spiritual milieu out of which he emerged, tells a story about each of these formative influences upon his growth. And the first one is well, or rather, the second story that he tells is a story about the Rav, and it will be familiar to people who've ever studied Rabbi Soloveitchik, but for those of you who haven't, I'll recite it here. He says, "Ma'aseh Shehaya." So it happened. Sa'ir liyamim ayisi kishehigid shiur mamaseches moed katan perik elam agach. I was a young man when Rabbi Soloveitchik was giving lectures upon tractate Moed Katan in the Talmud. Meshach shlosha shiurim hislabit betosos echad ad shibiteach shita ikvis v'sfir shetaneich hasdaito. And he spent three lectures analyzing, struggling how to interpret a comment by Tosos, one of the great commentators in the Talmud. And he spent days trying to come up with a consistent and sensible interpretation of Tosos. But chilas hashir sha'acharkach pasach hazegemar v'zakav einav bi'yivishal. Now, on the fourth day, when we all gathered together in the Rav's classroom, my grandfather recalls that the Rav turned to him and he asked, Maha Perish Petosos, what did the Tosos that we've spent the last 3 days studying and that I've now presented my thoughts on? What does Tosos say? Kamuvan, of course, is my grandfather. Chazarti al Teirutso Kimat Mila Bamila. I was able to repeat to the Rav his own brilliant explanation word for word. I had been paying attention. Lamar Bahafta, and to my great surprise, is my grandfather, his rages alai. He became angry with me. The Gar be Kaval Amva Eda. And he yelled at me in front of everybody. The Amar Hape, and he said to me, Hapeirshaze Anikvar Yodea. He says, that explanation that you just, I already know that explanation. Hello, Kachamarti Esmo. That was exactly what I told you yesterday. Anila Rotse Shitagidli Mashani Shani Omer. Ani Rotzalodas Masha Ta Omer. He says, listen, I know what I said yesterday. I don't want to know what I said. I said it. I want to know what you think. And if you want to remain in this classroom, said the Rav, if you want to remain under my tutelage, it is your responsibility to investigate the sources for yourself and not simply to repeat what you've heard from others. It's your responsibility to check and to investigate and to make sure that you understand the sources and that you yourself are satisfied with the explanation, not only that others give, but even that I myself have given, says the Rav. It was a noteworthy lesson in intellectual independence, the kind of intellectual independence that the Rav prized. But note, I want to contrast this story with another story that my grandfather tells about his other Rebbe, his other teacher, his own grandfather. And I want you to note the differences. We're not in person, so we can't be as interactive as I'd like, but I want you to follow along with me and note the difference between the similarities and the difference between the first and the second stories. My grandfather says here in the second story, is Dechirna Katave Natalia. I remember when I was a boy, Kaven Esner, about 10 years old, Vlambadnu Tosos Bipsacha, and we were learning a comment of Tosos. The story, again, focuses on a similar commentary. Kishatosvos mevi divrei Rashi maseches acheres bechdei lahakshos alav. And Tosvos quoted the comment of Rashi, an earlier commentator, on a completely different tractate, and he quoted those words here in order to ask a question about them and in order to attack them. Karasius divrei akuntras v'avarti alakushya. So I read the Tosafistic quote of Rashi's words, and then I proceeded to Tosfos's analysis. Vasaba hifsikosi, but my grandfather stopped me. And it was then that my grandfather stopped me. Vin masha Rashi omer, he says, you understand what Rashi said? Kain sab, of course, grandfather. Hayim omnam Rashi omer kain? Did Rashi really say that? Histakalti bo batimahon, I looked at him in shock. Vadai, hello, Tosfos mevim dvarav kach? He says, of course, Tosfos is one of the greatest Talmudic commentators in all of Jewish history. Just quoted Rashi. I just read the quote right there. Bini, Heshev Lisa, my son, my grandfather told me, Al tia atza, don't be lazy. Tatriach az atzmacha, get up off your tuchis. V'tageish la'aron asvarim, v'totzi es amaseches ba motzei Rashi azeh, v'tivdok ba'atzmacha, ma'kein tzadku atosu v'meshet tzatadu divir Rashi. Go up, get up, and check, just to make sure that Tosus is quoting Rashi correctly. Dalecha bini, and you should know, my son, that when it comes to religion, when it comes to Yahadus, when it comes to our faith, true faith and trust in God and in the bearers of tradition is a fundamental principle that we cannot dispense with. Zohi ha'emes la'amita binyanei emunas v'deos. This, when it comes to orthodoxy, when it comes to the beliefs that God demands of us, this is a fundamental principle. Aval, but, kishata nigash lakodesh pnima latama Torah, when it comes to the study of Torah, when it comes to study, to analysis, to intellectual battle, asur lecha liftach bebitachon. Faith is prohibited. Kishata lomed, when you're studying, alecha lahavi safka, your chashdan, your job when it comes to study, when it comes to learning, your job is not to be faithful. Your job is to be skeptical. Your job is to be cautious. Barak az yesh sikoi sheulai pam tagil alumnus. And only then will you have a chance, perhaps, to conquer the heights of Torah study. Now, these two stories are at a superficial glance, and even more than a superficial glance, quite nearly identical. Both of them are teaching a fierce independence when it comes to Torah study. Both of them are teaching that skepticism, when used appropriately, is not only not a threat to religion, it's actually a tool that God himself wields or expects us to wield on his behalf. Both of them include analysis of Tosfos. I mean, these stories are quite similar. They're teaching the same lessons. The difference is the tone. The Rav, as my grandfather portrayed it, was upset at him, was yelling at him, was screaming at him. And this was, I think, how students of the Rav often experienced him. He was, as my grandfather said in his eulogy for the Rav, he was a holy terror. His students were deeply, passionately, beautifully in awe of him. But the way that my grandfather describes his grandfather doesn't yell. His grandfather lovingly mocks him. His grandfather tells, don't be lazy, get up off the couch. His grandfather plays with him. And in fact, this was the primary difference between how my grandfather experienced his time with Rabbi Soloveitchik and his time with his grandfather. And I would just want to call to your attention, just to confirm this intuition, I want to call your attention to my grandfather's eulogy for his grandfather. It was delivered on the occasion of his grandfather's first yahrzeit, the first anniversary of his passing in 1949. When my grandfather wrote these words, this is of note, he was 24 years old. I mean, consider a 24-year-old today who could write this way and could speak this way. It's quite remarkable. My grandfather writes of his grandfather. As I now suddenly recollect the following scene, I'm sitting along the length of the long red table in his library with my back half turned to the big black volumes in the bookshelves. He's leaning over me in his shirt sleeves without a jacket, breathing warmly down my neck and bearing a faint scholarly nicotine odor about him. This is a different time. We're both peering into a Rambam, into Maimonides, trying to solve some intricate, to me anyway, problem which I have come across while studying. He noticed my difficulties and he asked me what was wrong. I told him of this problem and I explained my predicament. Now he's peering into the giant yellow-tinged volume for about a minute with his lips pursed till they almost touched his nose, leaning on the table with his left arm, turning the pages with his right hand. He now flexes his eyebrows, then lifts them. Still pondering the problem, he shakes his hand slowly, now downward to the right, now downward to the left, as if he's uncertain about the correctness of the Rambam, or rather, as if manifesting a slight appreciation of my kasha, my question. He then reverts to pressing his lips, this time for a very short while, and then suddenly his face lights up in a delightful smile and his eyes begin to dance. I know now for sure that he has detected a fallacy in my reasoning and is even laughing at himself for not having caught on immediately, although I later realized that the point was exceptionally subtle. The matter is explained to me in an organized, systematic, and detailed fashion, as if it had been prepared for weeks and had been carefully put into writing. And when I, says my grandfather, manifest the first happy signs of cognizance, usually accompanied with an outro on, ooh, which he mimics, which his grandfather mimicked, ridiculing me affectionately. He raises his face to me and lifts his eyebrows quizzically. I recognize the crystal clear challenge compounded of, well, why couldn't you do it? And Nunu, let's see if you can work this one. Followed by his presentation to me of a new but similar problem. My grandfather's relationship with his grandfather was rooted in playfulness, in fun, in smiling, in laughter. And though my grandfather became the Rosh Yeshiva, though he presided over a school that is steeped in the sharply analytical, deeply serious traditions of Lithuanian learning, the cerebral godless of the Litvak tradition. My grandfather was always and forever a Galicianer in a land of Litvaks. He was playful in a world of seriousness. He was in a yeshiva that sought to find the tzvedinim, the dialectical brilliance in all the words of Torah. But my grandfather was one who sought the appreciation of shivim panim laTorah, not of two dinim, but of 70 faces. My grandfather was a person who appreciated playfulness and loved it and thought it was an essential part of Torah. And so the question that I want to ask or that I want to tackle in our time remaining is, what sort of role did my grandfather think playfulness should play in a Torah worldview? And here, I believe that there are several questions, but in the interest of time, I'd like only to tackle two. First of all, how should an appreciation for playfulness, for laughter, for games, how should that impact the way that we learn? And number two, how should it impact the way that we approach the world? How should it impact our sense of politics, our sense of history? The first, of course, is personal, is subjective, is individual, and the second is collective and national. So let's take them both in turn. The first thing that we'll have to establish, and that my grandfather sought to establish in a critical essay that he wrote called A Jewish Ethic of Leisure, which he wrote in 1971. He published in his magnificent collection of essays called Faith and Doubt. My grandfather asked the very simple question, is there such a thing in Jewish law and Jewish thought and Jewish practice as leisure? If we're going to say that Torah should be playful, if we're going to say that Torah learning should be playful, if we're going to say that playfulness is good, we need to establish the idea that leisure time, that time for expending upon fun, upon humor, upon laughter, actually exists. Is there such a category in halacha, in Jewish practice, in Jewish thought? Now, my grandfather believed that the answer was a resounding yes, and he believed, in fact, that leisure itself was an invention of the Jewish tradition, and it was introduced into human thought in clear and direct opposition to the other two alternatives thrown up by the other great tradition underpinning Western civilization, and that was the Greek tradition. My grandfather pointed out that the God of the Hebrew Bible, the God of the Torah, was fundamentally different from the two gods proposed by the Greek tradition, the God of Aristotle and the God of Plato. My grandfather pointed out that the God of Aristotle, the Aristotelian God that so fascinated Maimonides, the Rambam, was known as the prime mover. This is a God who simply gave birth to everything else, at which point everything else kind of proceeded on its own. If you've heard the phrase deism, the idea that God creates the entire world and then steps back from it, that's the Aristotelian God, a God who is necessary in order to explain everything else in creation, but plays no subsequent role. This was the Aristotelian God. On the other hand, you have the Platonic God, the God of Plato. The God of Plato was what the philosophers called an emanationist God. That meant that God, as Plato understood it, had a nature, and God's nature was to constantly be creating. So every single thing was an emanation of God. If the Rambam, the rational tradition in Judaism, was fascinated by the Aristotelian God, the mystical tradition, the Kabbalah, the Zohar, was fascinated by the Neoplatonic God, by the Platonic God. Plato's God was constantly creating. Why? Because that's what God does. God always has to be creating. Everything is being created every second. And as my grandfather pointed out, the Torah, the Hebrew Bible, introduces God to civilization in a manner that directly opposes both of those conceptions. Aristotle's God is a God, as he put it, who is always on vacation. And to borrow a term from one of the great rock and roll albums, God is on permanent vacation. Why? Because God creates the world and then does nothing for the rest of eternity except contemplate himself. That's Aristotle's God. Aristotle's God is constantly on vacation, always resting. Plato's God is a slave to his nature. He's not constantly on vacation. He's constantly working. Plato's God is constantly creating because that's what he must do. He's a slave to his own nature. So if Aristotle's God is always on vacation, Plato's God is always working. The Hebrew Bible says God is neither of those things. God is neither forced to be on vacation nor forced to work. The God of the Hebrew Bible is a God of liberty, is a God of freedom, is a God who spends 6 days creating, 6 days working, and then a seventh day resting. God is the God who is neither on vacation, but neither always working. The God of the Torah is balanced. The God of the Torah is free. The God of the Torah is both. My grandfather therefore pointed out that the signal embodiment of this concept of God in Jewish life, the idea that God works and then rests, Shabbos, was for this reason understood to be such a massive innovation in the history of human wisdom, in the history of wisdom bequeathed to humans, that it was quite nearly incomprehensible to Greek civilization. How do we know? Take a look at the next source here. Let's take a look. My grandfather cited the tradition in the Talmud Bavli, which tells about the occasion of the translation of the Torah into Greek. The Greek translation of the Torah, which is called the Septuagint, because Septuaginta in Greek means 70. And so the tradition goes, the translation was undertaken by 70 wise men. The Talmud tells us that when the Greek, when the Bible was translated into Greek, the translators made certain deliberate free translations, or translations that seemed to depart from the Hebrew text. And the reason they did this was because the words as they were would have been so earth-shattering for Greek readers that they wouldn't have been able to understand them. And so one such example, and perhaps the most famous of them, is that Masa B'Talmai HaMelech, it happened during the reign of Ptolemy, of King Ptolemy, of the Ptolemaic Empire. Shekine Shivim Mishnayim Zekeinu Mechnisim B'Shivim Mishnayim Batav Lo Gilalem Amakinsa, who gathered all of these sages together, separated them into different rooms, and didn't tell them why. And he tested all of these sages by saying, translate for me the law of Moses. And he wanted to see if all of them would translate it the same way, to see if there was any consistency to the Jewish tradition. And God performed a miracle. And for the first time in all of history, never to be repeated again, 70 Jews got together and agreed upon something. And they all translated the Torah the same way. Now, God also, the tradition also says that not only did they all translate the Bible the same way, they also all mistranslated the Bible at the same crucial moments. What was one of them? Well, one way in which the Greek text, as the Talmud tells us, departs from the Hebrew text is what the Hebrew text tells us is Vayechal Elokim b'yom ha'shvi melachto asher asah, that God completed his work after 7 days, whereas the Greek translation tells us Vayechal b'yom ha'shishi v'yishbot b'yom ha'shvi, that God finished his work on the sixth day and then rested on the seventh day. So in the Hebrew, God works for 7 days, and on the seventh day, he also rests. Whereas in the Greek tradition, God works only for 6 days and rests on the seventh. What's the difference? The difference, my grandfather said, is that in the Hebrew version, in the Hebrew Bible, rest itself is an act of creativity. Rest itself, when the Bible says God works for 7 days, that's not, that is to say that what God works, what God does, what God creates on the seventh day is rest. Whereas in the Greek translation, now that idea, the idea that rest is something that is creative, is something that is worthwhile, it's something that's important, was revolutionary in the Greek-speaking world. In fact, the Greeks thought that the idea of resting as a positive good was so nonsensical that in fact they mock the Jews for this. You read the works of Tacitus, you read the works of Plutarch, when they describe the idea of the Jewish Sabbath, they accuse the Jews of inventing it because they were lazy, because they just didn't want to work for 7 days. The idea of rest as a positive, affirmative good, something that actually was so good that it needed to be created, was something that was entirely foreign to the Greek tradition. But that was precisely what the Bible was arguing, that in fact, there is a positive quality to resting, to leisure. Now, what was this positive quality? Well, my grandfather said that the positive form of leisure time, something that's not merely just killing, you know, what we would call killing time, but actually luxuriating in time. My grandfather said that the Hebrew term for leisure, something that, in fact, the Hebrew Bible introduced to the world, is menucha. The idea, what we would translate typically as rest, he translated as leisure. Now, what was the nature, what is the nature of leisure time in in Jewish thought? My grandfather said in Faith and Doubt, in his essay called A Jewish Ethic of Leisure, he says, what is the content of menucha such that it makes Shabbat, the Sabbath, the purpose of the rest of the week and comprises the universal dimension of Judaism's most distinctive religious institution? He says, the answer, I believe, lies in this. Isser malacha, the prohibition of labor on Shabbos, implies the cessation of our activities imposed by us as creative personalities upon the natural world. So in other words, my grandfather says, the Sabbath has two elements to it. It has a negative element and a positive element. The negative element is the prohibition of labor. You're not allowed to work on the Sabbath. That negative element informs us what the positive element is, because the positive element is its exact opposite. My grandfather says, authentic menucha requires that on the Sabbath, we direct these creative changes not onto nature, but onto ourselves, spiritually and intellectually. Menucha is not a suspension of our creative energies for one day of the week, but a refocusing of our creative talents upon ourselves. It would be a mistake, my grandfather believed, to describe the Sabbath as a day of rest, merely as a day on which we cease creating, or upon which we cease doing anything. Rather, we do create on Shabbos, but whereas the rest of the week, our creative energies are directed at the rest of the world, on Shabbos, our creative energies are directed at ourselves. My grandfather says the difference between the prohibited malacha and the recommended menucha, between labor and leisure, lies not in the fact of creativity, but in the object of one's creative powers, oneself or one's environment, the inner or the outer world. Now, my grandfather says that leisure, that what leisure therefore is the positive intent of a human being to change something, not about the rest of the world, but about ourselves. Much as God left the rest of the world and taught us something about his own nature on the seventh day, so too do we use leisure time. Do we use the Sabbath as well as other leisure time we may carve out? We use leisure time to change something, not about the rest of the world, but about ourselves. And there are two ways we can do that, my grandfather said. He said there is a form of leisure called Shvita, and there is a form of leisure called Nofesh. Shvita, perhaps we would translate as cessation, and Nofesh we would translate as transformation, or perhaps reflection and transformation. My grandfather says Shvita, the idea of ceasing all activity on Shabbos, that's a form of leisure that recommends to us that what we do is we stop doing everything so that we can figure out who we really are. We stop working because we aren't defined by our labor. We stop using our phones because we aren't defined by our electronics and our relationships with others. We stop doing all the things that we do to interact with the rest of the world because ultimately, at the end of the day, none of us are defined by how other people see us. We are defined by our relationship with our Creator. The Sabbath is the one day that we get to look at ourselves. Leisure time is when we get to look at ourselves, confront ourselves, and see who we really are. That's Shvita. That's only step one. My grandfather says step two is Nofesh. Step two is not just self-reflection, but self-transformation. Self-transformation means we take our leisure time not just to figure out who we are, but to change who we are, to apply our creative faculties to affect a new self. And that's what leisure time is for in the Jewish tradition. Leisure time is not just for playing games, for having fun, for killing time, for leaving in such a way that we leave ourselves exactly as we were once upon a time. Leisure time in the most ideal form is engaging in something playful in such a way that it actually changes who we are. Now, for my grandfather, the highest form of being able to change who you are was through Torah study, which is what he thought was the ideal way to use leisure time, to study Torah. Now, to be clear, my grandfather was not someone who did not appreciate pop culture. He was a huge fan of MASH and a huge fan of Everybody Loves Raymond. However, He certainly didn't have the instinctive love for pop culture that I share. So in that respect, I like to think that if I had more time, I could have convinced him. But I may be wrong about that. However, how should my grandfather's sense of playfulness, of fun, affect the way we study Torah? Well, my grandfather thought that the idea of nofesh, of self-transformation, of surprise, of whimsy, of laughter, that should affect not just the way we consume culture, not just the way we look at life. It should actually transform the way that we study. And in this respect, my grandfather believed that the way that we study Torah classically in the yeshiva world is actually wonderful, but in some ways insufficient. My grandfather, in fact, proposed at the end of the essay, he said, perhaps we may have to devise a form of game-oriented study. My grandfather believed that it was important in studying Torah to be playful, to be whimsical. And if you insist all the time on precise definitions, that everything should be dialectical, that everything should be just so, if you bring a philosopher's bent to every single act of study, that's not play, that's work. That's when study becomes work. In order to preserve this sense of leisure, this sense of nofesh, this sense of self-transformation in Torah study, we need to actually bring back the much maligned pilpul, the idea of bringing sources from all across the world of the landscape of Torah, bringing them together in marvelous, grand, and whimsical conversation. And now pilpul was much maligned in the yeshiva world because it was unsystematic. And in the Christian world, by way of comparison, you have a similar critique of non-systematic theology. In the Jewish world, you have the same thing. The idea, oh well, it's not rigorous. My grandfather said, those who opposed pilpul believed in straight and unencumbered analysis. One would be hard put to find anyone reckless enough, in the yeshiva world at least, to venture a defense, let alone advocacy of pilpul today. In truth, pilpul has been unfairly maligned, for this is the way the intellect plays, the way the mind indulges in its delightful games and exercises. And if you read my grandfather's Torah, if you read the Torah of Galicia, if you read the Torah of those who are outside of Lithuania, you can see that form of whimsy, that form of laughter in Torah study. And my grandfather believed that that's what we're missing in our yeshiva. We're so dead set on rigor that we've forgotten on Torah study as work, that we've forgotten Torah study as play. Now, in the remaining minute or two here, I want to perhaps open up another aspect of my grandfather's sense of why playfulness and humor and fun was so important. And that was how my grandfather believed that we should approach not just ourselves, working on ourselves and our own personal relationship with God, but also how he believed that we should act collectively as a people, both culturally and even on the stage of politics. And here, my grandfather believed that playfulness, that sense of whimsy, was missing from our culture and our time as well, or rather our Jewish worldview as well. My grandfather believed as well that in the realm not just of personal relationships with God, but in the realm of the collective, of politics, my grandfather also believed that the Torah introduced a revolution into the wide world of wisdom. If in the case of one's individual relationship with God, this was by rejecting both the Aristotelian concept of God on permanent vacation and the Neoplatonic version of God who's essentially a slave, in the world of politics and history as well, Jewish tradition in the Hebrew Bible introduced the revolution. In this case, however, the revolution was by rejecting two different poles. In my grandfather's day, he believed that these two poles, he referred to these two poles as indeterminism and determinism. And we have important and very influential corollaries of these movements today, but let's define them. My grandfather believed that prior to the Torah and even long afterwards, there are essentially two views of how the world works. The first is indeterminism. Indeterminism essentially says that the universe is a crapshoot. There's no order. It's all essentially arbitrary. It's all chance. And if we seek to find coherence in this universe of ours, we're merely fooling ourselves, and we're allowing ourselves to be deluded by our own need for security and comfort. That was one view, and it was popular once upon a time in the days of ancient paganism. The notion that the gods don't care about us; they're simply petty, venal beings who fight with each other. All we can do is try and manipulate them. Nothing really matters, and that idea persists, of course, today. In some of the most militant forms of atheism. On the other side were the determinists. Now, in my grandfather's day, and even today, although they're less prominent in an immediate sense, but in my grandfather's day, the primary bearers of the determinism standard were Marxists and communists. Karl Marx famously believed that religion was the opiate of the masses, and what he meant by that was that if you want to really know how the world works, you shouldn't turn to faith, you shouldn't turn to religion, you shouldn't even turn to culture. If you want to understand how the world works, look at economics. Everything is determined by class, everything is determined by money, everything is determined by class warfare. If you want to know how the world works, economics is where it's at. This is why Marx, the manner in which Marx innovated the idea of economic determinism, the idea that everything could really ultimately be explained by our economic interdependence with each other. So on the one hand, you have people who think the world is simply arbitrary, nothing matters. Others who think that everything is predictable, everything is predetermined by simply reading off some cipher in human affairs, whether it's economics, politics, or something else. The modern successors of these views, and I think this is where my grandfather's view on the Torah perspective here is very helpful. I think the clearest inheritors of these two views is, on the one hand, the inheritors of indeterminism, the idea that everything is arbitrary, is what today we might call sort of the cult of scientism, the idea that there really is there's no God, there's no theology, everything's just random chance, just study the laws of the universe and you'll somehow figure out how everything works, but there's no use in asking why anything works. The only question is what or how. Science, of course, well, my grandfather was a chemist, so my grandfather was a great partisan of science, but scientism was something that he abhorred. Those are the modern day standard bearers of indeterminism. The modern day standard bearers of determinism, the idea that everything is predetermined by some code or another, I think is probably what we would call today wokeness or wokeism, the idea that everything's predetermined not by economics, but by ethnicity or race, right? Race is destiny. The idea that the club or group that we belong to determines everything about us and should determine everything about our place in society. So this is sort of the binary choice that we encounter in culture in my grandfather's day and even today. We're either confronted with an arbitrary universe with no God or a God presiding over a world in which everything's predetermined. Now, the Torah, by contrast, totally rejects this binary. God's not arbitrary, but neither does God work like an ATM machine, right? Or a mathematical formula where you kind of like punch in variables and God spits out a solution. The God of the Hebrew Bible is a God who plays games, is a whimsical God. How do you know? The Torah tells us. In Exodus 10, Ulaman tisaper boznei bincha, ven bincha is asher salalti b'mitzrayim ve'esos osai asher samti vam b'idatem k'ini Hashem. In between the seventh and eighth plagues, God, when he tells Moses to proceed with the next plague upon the Egyptians, God says that the pedagogical result of this, of God's encounter with Egypt was that one day you, the Israelites, should tell your children and your children's children how hisalalti, how I played, how I mocked Pharaoh, how I played games with him. And in fact, the Psalms describe God in similar fashion. In Tehillim, Yoshev b'shamayim yischak, Hashem yilag lamo, that while kings and princes and magistrates plot and plan and scheme, God sits in the heavens and he laughs and he makes mockery of those who think they control the world. God plays games. God is whimsical. Now, what does this mean? What are the virtues of God being a whimsical God? Well, there are three virtues. And in an exemplary sermon from 1974, and this was my grandfather's reaction to the Yom Kippur War, to the disaster occurring then in the Suez. My grandfather says, "I do not mean to sound sacrilegious when I say that there's a certain amount of fun in the downfall of a pharaoh, not in the sense of revenge, not as if it were a circus, not as a form of entertainment. There was too much human tragedy for that. But fun in the sense of the tension of a game building to its climax, in the sense of the combination of irony and the deflation of pomposity and the sudden exposure of impotence and psychological nakedness that so often underlie pretentiousness. God as a game player, God as a whimsical, humorous, a God who laughs, he does so for three reasons. First of all, because the world we live in is not a world of mathematics. It's a world in which free beings are present, in which we have free will. And when people have free will, life becomes surprising. And surprises are not bad, they're good. They're a sign that we live in a world of freedom. And so first of all, the tension of a game building to its climax. God loves dramatic tension. God loves stories. God loves human beings acting freely. Number one. Number two, games have a way of puncturing the pompous, of revealing that people who think that they're so high and mighty are in fact nothing of the sort. Drama allows us to lay bare the behavioral impurities and improprieties of people who think that they're better than others. And finally, games give us hope. We all know that a game is never, as much as when we're watching a sports game, we all know it's never over until it's over. Reggie Miller can score 8 points in the last couple of seconds. We all know the game's never over, and that's why games are good. So my grandfather's sense of how we should think about laughter and fun and humor in a collective sense, not just in how we learn, but in how we approach the world, is that we should first of all understand that our God is the God of Israel, the God of the Hebrew Bible, is a whimsical one. And this means that we should oppose, as my grandfather thought, two negative tendencies in Jewish life. The first was Jewish determinism, the idea that the whole world is anti-Semitic, everyone hates us, nothing will ever change. That's why it's so important to understand that God plays games. Anyone who's ever watched sports knows that the worst kind of person to watch sports with is the kind of person who's just like, oh, we're going to lose. We're definitely going to lose. Like, the worst person to watch sports with is the person who thinks it's all over before it's even begun. Determinism is bad. God plays games, and games, like a sports match, like a chess match, games have dramatic tension. They always give us a chance for hope. And number two, the idea of God as a game player also helps us fight against Jewish indeterminism. The idea that there's the idea amongst some of the Jewish intelligentsia, even of our own day, there's no God, there's no use for tradition, there's no reason to care about Judaism as a religion. It's the sort of thing you'd find like in the worst of Haaretz, I guess. Right? It's no surprise that I think such Jewish commentators who think that tradition is useless and spirituality is a bore, the kind of people who bristle at the idea that we must answer to God, quickly end up finding someone that they do wish to answer to. Usually it ends up being elite tastemakers of the EU or whatever NGO is trendy that week. But instead, the way we should approach things, the way we should approach Jewish politics, a worldview, a sense of history, is that we should understand that we are participants in God's games. We have, and that means that we have hope that things can, will, and do get better. We as a people can make friends with people who we were enemies with in previous generations. We can be an economic powerhouse where once we were limited to this or that profession. And also we have to know that ultimately we're answerable to God's rules. We have to be faithful stewards of our tradition. We have hope that things can turn around, but ultimately we play by rules. My grandfather, in sum, believed that one of the great threats to a healthy Jewish worldview was humorlessness, was taking ourselves too seriously. And I've gone over, so I will leave you with a final thought to illustrate the importance of this, the sense of of playfulness as an essential component of Jewish theology, both as individuals and as a collective. As Rabbi Penner mentioned this morning, just before my grandfather's yahrzeit, my wife Shalmit and I were able to name our newborn son. And we named him after my grandfather. His name is Norman Lamb. And one of the points that I recounted at the Bris was that the last time I ever saw my grandfather was both deeply painful and ultimately, I think, inspiring. It was deeply painful because by the end of his life, my grandfather could not do any of the things that made him who he was. He was one of the greatest teachers who ever lived, who could no longer teach. He was one of the greatest thinkers who ever lived, who could barely think. One of the greatest writers who ever lived, who could no longer write. He couldn't speak the last time that I saw him, just a few days before he passed away. There was, however, one thing that he could still do. And I recounted this at the Bris this morning, but my grandfather and I used to have a joke when he started having to use a wheelchair, when he still could interact. He hated his wheelchair. He hated being in a wheelchair. And every time we would see each other, we would joke. He started it, but we would joke with each other. Every time I would see him in a wheelchair, one or both of us would exclaim, "Sus paro verichbo." Oh, it's the chariot of Pharaoh. The chariots of Pharaoh that drowned in the Red Sea. And the last time that I saw him, I was trying to communicate with him, and I couldn't get through. I tried everything, and I couldn't get through. Finally, I looked at the chair he was sitting, the wheelchair he was sitting in, and I exclaimed, "Sus paro verichbo." And he smiled at me and he laughed. The last thing, the one thing that a Kadosh Baruch Hu didn't or maybe couldn't take away from him, the last thing that he held on to, b'kol kocho, with all of his strength, was his smile, was his laughter, was his sense of whimsy, his sense of playfulness. And I look at this, I looked at it at the time as a mercy, that God left him his humor. But I see now that in fact, it wasn't his humor, his laughter, his smile wasn't a booby prize. It wasn't a runners-up medal. It was the most important thing he had to teach us. Because if you can look at Jewish history, if you could look at world history, if you could look at your own personal circumstances, as terrible as they are, and you can smile and you can laugh, then what you have achieved is the one thing that every single civilization in all of history has sought but never achieved, and that is immortality. The Greeks sought immortality. They dipped Achilles in the Styx, and he was felled by the arrow of a nobody of Paris. The Romans sought immortality. They tried to make their Caesars into gods, and every single one died from one sickness or assassination or another. The Egyptians sought immortality, and their civilization is dust. The only civilization that ever sought immortality and actually achieved it were the Jews. Because we taught our children how to laugh in the face of danger, in the face of pain, in the face of challenges. And we taught our children how to hope. At the end of the day, Athens had admirers, but Jerusalem had children. Athens threw parties. Jerusalem smiled. At the end of the day, an essential component of Jewish thought, not an ancillary part, not a part that allows us to recharge so we can do the real thing, an essential part of Jewish philosophy, theology, practice, halacha, worldview, is laughter. The last thing my grandfather ever did in my presence. Show me the most important thing that we could do. That is imitate God. As divine image bearers, we could do the one thing that God does in the heavens, and that is Yoshev Bashamayim Yischak. We can laugh. Thank you so much to Rabbi Penner, to Yeshiva University, for giving me the opportunity to reflect upon this